Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for August Small Animal Practice Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, RCVS and European Specialist in Small Animal Internal Medicine, Amanda Paul. Thank you, Amanda. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hi everyone, thanks for joining us today. So there's a lot to talk about in regards to diabetic ketoacidosis in dogs. They're such so and cats. They're so metabolically unstable. So I'm going to try and fly through some slides, but then I'm going to slow down in others when I think that there's more of an important note to be made. And if I see questions coming up that I think I'm going to answer later, I'll try and address them at the end if you feel that I've missed them, or if there's something that I think don't think I'll be addressing, I'll try and stop and address it as they come. So what we're going to do today is I'm just going to do a little recap on the pancreas. We're going to talk about diabetes itself and then the sick diabetes. Now, I know today is diabetic ketoacidosis, but I'm just going to allude in a couple of points to it, or areas to the hyperosmolar syndrome that can occur as well too, because it's a little bit more rare in our dogs and cats compared to people, but we still definitely see it. We don't see this marked ketosis, but our main focus today is actually going to be on the diabetic ketoacidosis. So moving right along in our time frame, it's going to be a basic recap. Just remembering that our pancreas, it's located close to the stomach and in close proximity to the duodenum. The portal blood effectively is what gives most of our pancreas its blood supply, and then it distributes itself through the islets and the acinar tissue. And that acinar portal circulation allows those islet hormones to exert their trophic and inhibitory effects on all those acinar cells in the pancreas. Insulin, in particular, and pancreatic polypeptide are trophic for this acinar tissue. And then we think of somatostatin and glucagon, which are a little bit more inhibitory. So I'm going to move on from the basic anatomy, because I'm sure we're all aware of it, and move more so into getting to our diabetic hormones. Insulin itself as a factor, I think that we need to completely understand how insulin works in terms of dealing with our DKA patients. So it has that central regulation of carbohydrate and fat metabolism in the body, and it causes the cells in the liver, the muscle, and fat tissue to take up that glucose from the blood, storing it as glycogen in the liver and the muscle. Insulin effectively stops the use of fat as an energy source by inhibiting the release of glucagon. And I think that's an important thing to remember when we start working out in why we have ketoacidosis. So when insulin's absent, glucose isn't taken up by the body cells, and the body begins to use fat as an energy source, or gluconeogenesis. So you might see transfer of lipids from adipose tissue to the liver for mobilization of it as an energy source. So the diagram there you'll see is our little islet of Langerhans that's sitting there in the pancreas, and obviously the beta cells producing that insulin. Now, moving straight into diabetes, typically in dogs, we've always regarded them as having, type 1, so an absolute deficiency of insulin. And these dogs, we've always thought, okay, these guys always need to go on to some sort of insulin. We're less likely to try and use medications or drugs that might, that we might use in a cat, and where there's impaired insulin resistance. So typically, our fat cats. And it's been often regarded that in cats there's inadequate insulin secretion, but I think we've moved forwards a lot in our understanding of cats, and there's been a lot of really good work that has shown that if we get insulin on board to cats very quickly when they're diagnosed with diabetes, we have a greater chance of actually achieving remission. What we don't see on the slide is the other consideration that we can see type 3 diabetes or secondary diabetes, which arises from insulin antagonism or non-specific destruction of the islets in, say, inflammation of the pancreas, whether it's necrotizing or neoplastic. And probably the one that we're most familiar with is in pregnant bitches, where there's an endogenous progesterone from pregnancy, and there's persistent calprolutea. And often that we see these type 3 diabetes occur about 3 to 4 weeks post estrus. So the thing to remember here too is not only are you dealing with a diabetic mum who's pregnant, so you're having to deal with this type 3 diabetes, but often that increased progesterone in pregnancy and the hyperglycemia increases the secretion of fetal growth hormone. So these pups may also be quite large at term, and that's something to can take into consideration as a side issue that you might be having to think about a cesarean in these dogs as well too. Estrogen reduces the sensitivity of the dog, of dogs to insulin, and it exacerbates diabetes at estrus, which can also occur in dogs. But there is that third type, and often if you can manage that concurrent disease, you may actually be able to achieve some degree of remission, or in the bitch with a type 3 diabetes, you may actually be able to reverse the condition if you consider spaying her afterwards, after her pregnancy. So what we commonly see in dogs is that, there's an age, 4 to 14-year-olds, it has been broadly reported in, and there seems to be a peak if you look through most of the literature at around 7 to 9 years of age. Females seem to be a little bit more predisposed than males in dogs, and obesity, as we would naturally think, does increase the risk. They always are insulin dependent, so you need to get insulin into these dogs when they're diagnosed. There are an overrepresentation of breeds, and probably what I've seen the most is often the little Australian and Yorkshire and Cairn Terriers seem to come into the clinic more commonly than other dogs, and they can be often the most challenging to regulate. Schnauzers are also very, very commonly seen in referral practice as well too, and they're often presenting with their cataracts, as you can see in this photo, and needing to be dealt with. Cats, and as I said, cats, it tends to be an insulin resistant, but at the time of diagnosis, they're usually insulin dependent. And we do tend to see more commonly males represented in females. And you may ask, look, why is that? Why is that? Does that occur? And it's because males seem to be predisposed to obesity. When they're obese, they also have a significantly greater mass of adipose tissue than affected females. And so the greater the fat mass, the less effect the insulin is at lowering the blood glucose. Male lean cats have a reduced tissue sensitivity to insulin than females, and this can decline further with weight gain. Obese males also appear to be more likely to develop fasting hyperinsulinemia than obese females. So that seems to be why males are a little bit more overrepresented. As we know, remission is always possible, particularly if we're quite aggressive in their management at the start. And we do see an over presentation of Burmese dogs, and that seems to be across the world, both Australia, the UK, and it's also been recognised in the US as well too. So moving ahead through and getting into the sick diabetic, and it's like, why do we get the sick diabetic? And it's frequently some sort of underlying stressful events that precipitates this shift from diabetes mellitus into DKA or a non-ketotic hyperosmolar diabetes mellitus. And so it may be anything from a urinary tract infection, a viral, a bacterial, or an inflammatory disorder, or often even another endocrine disorder such as hyperadrenocorticism in the dog, and we'll allude to that further at the end of the presentation. When we go through our diagnosis, often people use, oh, what's the minimum database I use? And I don't really like that terminology because I think every case is individually different in some way or another. But it's very important to try and determine, is there an underlying precipitating event? And your CBC, your biochemistry, your electrolytes and blood gas, and your urinalysis are going to give you that. The big question is the beta-hydroxybutyrate. There can often be quite a delay in getting that back from the lab. It is a strong acid, and it's obviously what we're using in our diagnosis of diabetic ketoacidosis. It is the most common strong acid that we actually see in the dog and cat, so more so the dog and cat than what we see in people. Then we look at, okay, what's further underlying? Is there an infection that's present? Do we do endocrine tests? Do we do an abdominal ultrasound? And cats do seem to have a presence of hyperthyroid as a concomitant disease. And in dogs, as I mentioned just a moment ago, adrenocorticism is very common. But when we have our sick diabetic ketoacidotic patient, we delay testing as the uncontrolled disease will affect the results. And we really want to stabilize them before we go on that mission to determine do they have that other disease. So in diabetic ketoacidosis, it is rare in dogs and it's uncommon in cats. And it can be associated with quite a significant mortality. And we see that ketonemia and ketonuria. Now, when we have the really sick diabetic coming in, often what is failed to be recognized is hyperglycemic hyperosmolar syndrome. It is even less common than DKA. It's more commonly seen in people and it's associated with a much poorer prognosis. There's usually a concurrent disease and these are the ones that come in with neurological signs. They're quite profoundly obtunded and it can often be due to the fact that they've got quite a significant shift in their osmolarity. And one of the mistakes we make is correcting it too quickly and causing massive sodium shifts, massive blood glucose shifts, ending up with demyelination and obviously sometimes irreversible neurologic disease. So it's something to be aware of when you do see your very sick diabetic patient coming in when you can't identify either ketones in the urine or ketones in the blood. What's happening in that hyperglycemic hyperosmolar syndrome is that there's just sufficient insulin to control lipolysis, but it's basically insufficient to control the hyperglycemia. And with these cases, you often see concurrent renal failure, infection, neoplasia, and sometimes gastrointestinal disease as well too. When we're looking at these patients and we're going through when we're making the diagnosis, a common comment that we get is that, oh, there are no urine ketones. And it just could be because often the ketone sticks, there's a nitroprusside reaction which detects acetoacetate and acetone, but it doesn't detect beta-hydroxybutyrate, which may be the only ketone that actually reaches renal threshold. So that may be why you see an absence of ketones in the actual urine, is because it is beta-hydroxybutyrate is the most common strong acid or the most common ketone that we see in dogs and cats, but it just hasn't reached that, it's reached the renal threshold, but acetoacetate and acetone actually haven't done that. So that may be giving you a little bit of a false negative result if you're concerned that your patient actually does have diabetic ketoacidosis. And you may then want to be considering looking at beta-hydroxybutyrate in your serum. So when we look at the whole process of diabetic ketoacidosis, it really occurs, as I said at the start, with that unconstrained ketone formation and a metabolic acidosis and dehydration. So with the deficiency of insulin, we have this hepatic lipid metabolism being quite deranged. And so these fatty acids or non-esterified fatty acids are converted to acetyl-CoA rather than being incorporated into fats or into triglycerides. These acetyl-CoA are then converted to acetoacetyl-CoA and acetoacetic acid and beta-hydroxybutyrate, as I said, primarily in dogs and cats, and our acetone. And this accumulation of ketones and lactic acid and loss of electrolytes and water in the urine lead to that profound dehydration and hypovolemia with then concurrent metabolic acidosis and shock that you see. So the ketonuria and osmotic diuresis, which is caused by the glycosuria, lead to these sodium and potassium lost, which exacerbates that hypovolemia and dehydration. We then get concurrent vomiting because the chemoreceptor trigger zone in the brain is triggered by the ketonemia and hyperglycemia, which causes further fluid losses, electrolyte losses, and that ongoing nausea and anorexia. And then this is all perpetuated by the stress hormones of cortisol and epinephrine, which contribute to that hyperglycemia. And then the severe dehydration that's occurring as a result of all that then leads to this hyperviscosity. And we can then have concurrent problems of thromboembolism, severe metabolic acidosis, renal failure, and sort of finally death. So that all contributes to why it tends to have such a poor prognosis and why we can get up to about 25% mortality. And in some studies, there's even greater numbers reported. So all DKA animals are going to have an absolute or relative deficiency of insulin, and there's always going to be those counter-regulatory hormones that we've got to sort of shut down or work across as well too to get these animals more metabolically stable. So what are we dealing with when we're dealing with the patients? We're dealing with that shock first. We're dealing often with a pre-renal azotemia and sometimes a secondary acute kidney injury, metabolic stress, these increased catecholamines and the hyperviscosity, which all wrap up to be quite a medical conundrum that we actually have to treat. So, how do these animals come into the hospital? Effectively, they're very lethargic, sometimes quite obtunded. We had a patient that came in about 11 o'clock last night that had no menace responses, no pupillary light reflexes, severely obtunded, and that was all effectively through dehydration. We use the word depression. I often don't like it because it's a term we often use with human emotion, but depressed or obtunded, dehydrated, they've often had vomiting, can often have quite acute abdominal pain if there's concurrent pancreatitis, and they're quite tachypneic and weak. As that progresses and becomes more severe, you can sometimes, and there are some people that are better at picking this up than others, you can have a strong odor of acetone on the breath. And within our team, we have two people out of eight that are picking up strong odors of acetone where the others can't. So your nose either has it or it doesn't, but you can sometimes smell that acetone on the breath. They can have dyspnea with this slow, deep breathing, and in people, they call it Kussmaul's respiration. And so it's a compensation effectively for the metabolic acidosis. And it tends to be a quite good indicator of the diabetic ketoacidosis condition. Those patients that come in with these Kussmaul breathing, so this dyspnea with slow, deep respiration, if you look at their blood gases, they often have a low partial pressure of CO2. They often have a low bicarbonate because of that forced increased respiration. They're really blowing off their carbon dioxide with this. And the base excess you see on the bloods is severely negative. So that's a common thing that you can actually see, particularly more so in I've noticed it more in our dogs than cats, but you definitely see it in both species. Cats tend to become very recumbent and moribund, and those patients that die tends to be more that hypervolemia and the hyperviscosity of blood. There is the severe acidosis, but often it's more so the hypervolemia and the hyperviscosity. So they're the things that we have to start thinking about straight away when we're actually talking about what do we do and how do we actually get our treatment. This is probably a cat that came in, and I have to say, I did steal the image from elsewhere. But often, when we see our semi-affected DKA cats, they come in and they're sitting right back in this plantigrade stance, which is a real sign of weakness. I mean, the first thing when I look at this cat, I think of is what's its potassium doing or what's its blood glucose doing. So that plantigrade weakness is something where, first of all, I'm not thinking orthopedic disease. Straight away, I'm thinking, how is this cat doing metabolically and what do I need to do to correct it? So just recapping, and I won't spend too much time here, with our DKA patients, we're dealing with the severe hyperglycemia, the metabolic acidosis, we're resolving that ketonemia, and when we're doing that, the ketonuria will follow. We're having to deal with often severe hyperosmolality, which is quite significant when we're thinking about how we give our fluids and how we actually correct. And then we're dealing with that osmotic diuresis, which is also causing a loss of sodium, potassium, and our other electrolytes. Our hypervolemic shock is, as I said, one of the first things that we're dealing with. And I'm not going to focus on it because I think we should get straight into how we manage and how we treat these patients. So, prioritizing, how do we care for that patient that does have DKA? Fluids is number one. Fluids is the first thing that we need to get on board. And I probably listed these incorrectly because if I had to prioritize, fluids is number one, insulin is number two, then I start thinking of what I need to do with our electrolytes, and then how do I then reverse metabolic acidosis? So probably fluids, insulin, electrolytes, and then reversal of the metabolic acidosis. And then I'm starting to focus on making sure that I've got adequate nutrition going into these patients as well too. So how do we cope with the fluids? What's the ideal crystalloid to use during fluid resuscitation? So it's some clinicians prefer to use, straight out saline to provide the least degree of osmolar shift when there's severe hyperglycemia present, and to treat that hyponatremia that we get when we lose sodium constantly through our urine. I think that there's certainly nothing you could say that would be ultimately wrong with that, but it is an acidic fluid, so it's not going to correct the acidemia as effectively as a balanced buffered isotonic solution such as plasmolite or Normosol, if you can actually get your hands onto it. The big thing I just want to notice right from the start is one of the mistakes that I can see often is that sodium bicarbonate. People sort of see these severely acidotic patients and they give sodium bicarbonate at the start. So that is something that we don't recommend. And the first thing you've got to do is correct with your fluids. So keep that metabolic acidosis, an eye on the metabolic acidosis. You may need sodium bicarbonate down the line, but don't use it right at the start. Fluids are often alone going to help you with correcting the acidotic state. So my recommendation is that I tend to use a buffered isotonic replacement crystalloid. The next big question is, oh, well, should I be giving something with lactate? And the question of using, lactated Ringer's solution or Hartmann's, sort of people have sort of said, well, I'm steering away from it because lactate is going to be metabolized by the liver. Effectively, you just need a few liver cells and, to actually be able to cope with that. So don't hesitate to use this buffered solution realistically if it's the only one you have. My preference is plasmolite, and it's because of the buffers of acetate and gluconate are both metabolized by the muscle to bicarb. And there's more muscle in the body than liver, so there's some degree of benefit in considering I need to fluid resuscitate my patient, as well as I also need to start considering what I'm going to do in terms of management of the overall acidosis. So I find that helps with the correction of the acidosis straight off the start. The other benefit I like with using plasmolite is there's no, as you can see on the chart there's no calcium in it. So if I need to give any solutions that are likely to precipitate out with calcium, I know I can give them with plasmolite. If you've got access to Normosol R, you can use it, and you can also use it with your sodium chloride. But you really need to think carefully if you're giving any solution that will precipitate with calcium if you're going to use lactated Ringer's. So if all you've got in stock is sodium chloride and lactated Ringer's, and you're going to be giving things like phosphate, or you might need to give blood products, then you may be better off using sodium chloride from the start. The important thing is that we need to get fluids on board, and that's the first thing that we need to, getting a catheter into these patients, giving them fluids from the start, correcting their dehydration, as well as considering what is going to happen in terms of our sodium shifts later on. So I'm not, this effectively was dealt with on the last slide, and it just again highlights, if I pointed out that, I'll just move this around the screen, that there's no calcium in plasmolite, there's no calcium in normal saline, but there is in our lactated Ringer's. If we're worried about sodium shifts, which we're definitely worried more so with our hyperosmolar glycemic patients, if you look at this, our sodium here in our lactated Ringer's is about 130. In our plasmolite, 140, and our normal saline, 154. So, if we're worried about an animal that's had a prolonged change in its sodium, and we need to correct that slowly, and we're looking at something at once they're stable of about half a millimole per hour, and we don't want to shift it too quickly, then we're better off maybe using a bit more of a balanced solution in the plasmolite, or maybe using the normal saline so we don't get such rapid changes that are more likely to cause myelinolysis. I finally got the word out. So more likely to cause changes to the nerves. So how do we go about correcting it? First thing is we want to correct that dehydration. So we make an estimate. If we've got anywhere up to about 6% dehydration, it's going to be really hard to make that assessment off the body condition alone. Once we start getting above 6% dehydration, we might start to see a little bit more sunken eyelids, those very dry mucous membranes, the skin tenting, and we can make greater estimates. If I don't have any of those signs like sunken eyelids, I make an assumption that I've probably got about a 6% dehydration. There is going to be some degree of hypovolemia, so I'm not going to need to correct that. So I'm going to assume 6%. Then we focus on correcting that dehydration. And when we do that calculation, a 6%, I've seen that another mistake that is made is we times in 6 by body weight by 1,000 mils or 0.6. 6% is 0.06. So you don't want to fluid overload your patient, but that's going to help you with correcting that dehydration to start with. Then going to estimate those maintenance requirements, so typically how we do in most of our patients, and then work out what our ongoing losses are going to be, whether they're sensible, so sort of losses through respiration, or insensible, so vomiting and diarrhea. And it's always the challenge because this is a guesstimate. You're looking at your patient, you're working out how much vomiting, diarrhea has there been, trying to talk to the owners and get that appreciation. So there is a certain degree of fudge factor or guess that actually goes on. As I say, the big thing that I want that I would look at is always avoiding those hypotonic shift changes in sodium. So just keep an eye on your sodium as you're going along with your fluid plan. There's no set fluid rate, as I said. It's going to be that working out that dehydration, the maintenance, and those continuing losses. And then the question is how fast do you correct over? And again, I tend to sort of work it out on how long the patient's been sick. If it's been very acute, I might try and replace those fluids over 8 to 12 hours. But if it's been more chronic, or the patient has a heart murmur, which is more likely to succumb to volume overload, it might sometimes have to be over 24 to 48 hours and correcting it very, very, very slowly so that I'm not going to cause that fluid overload. So it again, there has to be a judgment on how quickly this patient became dehydrated, and when I'm calculating out fluid components, am I actually going to am I going to stress the patient too much? The again, it's and I don't think I can sort of I can emphasize it enough is that we just it's the most important thing to correct that hydration. Once you get those fluids on board, you are going to cause some degree of diuresis, which is automatically going to start reducing your blood glucose levels. So it's going to come out with your osmotic diuresis. It is not going to do anything to correct your ketones, which is why the next step in the fluid or in the management plan of the diabetic ketoacidotic patient is you need to get insulin in. Without insulin, you are not going to correct the ketotic state. You are going to correct the hyperglycemic state, but not the ketotic state. And I'm going to move on. So again, it's just emphasizing that osmolality, that when we're sort of looking at these patients, we don't want to cause too many shifts. Our rapid shifts is going to cause swelling of the brain, so we're going to have neurological deterioration by any kind of rapid shift. We want to try and work towards maintaining a normal osmolality, but we're going to be doing that slowly. And we just know that severe hyperglycemia pulls water into the vasculature, it dilutes the serum and sodium level, and it can cause this pseudo hyponatremia. So as that blood glucose level decreases, the sodium level is effectively going to increase in our patients. So before jumping into insulin, I'm going to mention electrolytes because the one thing that we need to be aware of is if we have a markedly hypokalemic patient, so a low potassium in our patient when they come in, and we're about to start giving insulin, because potassium is intracellular, that insulin is going to help draw it into the cells. So our patients are going to become even more hypokalemic. So before giving insulin, we always need to look at our electrolytes and need to make sure are we supplement do we how much do we need to supplement right from the start. So electrolyte anemia and anemia tend to be actually consequences of the diabetic ketoacidosis therapy, not the cause of ketosis. So we're actually starting to identify that these are going to be problems. Let's deal with them from the start in terms of our therapy rather than the DKA actually being the direct cause of them. So starting with potassium, because this is our big one, the Effectively, hypokalemia is going to increase the resting potential. So it's going to actually make it more negative. It's going to push, if I can get this arrow pointer to work, hopefully. Sorry about that. So it's going to push this resting membrane potential to a lower point. So makes it more negative. And what that does is it tends to hyperpolarize the cell and make it less excitable. And this is why it's so important that we need to make sure that we're starting to correct that hypokalemia prior to starting insulin. So the other thing that can sometimes happen, and as hypokalemia is more common, but in the patients where they're also coming in with acute kidney injury or AKI, these patients can sometimes come in quite hyperkalemic, and this will make the resting membrane potential less negative, i.e., it makes the cell a lot more hyperexcitable, and that's the last thing that we need as well too, because with that we start seeing changes in our ECG, and that can be quite significant when we're having to worry about heart rates and the effect on the heart itself. So while we're staying on potassium, with the hypokalemic patients, we often see that a low heart rate. We see sinus bradycardia. And some patients don't necessarily exhibit cardiac signs even when the potassium falls quite low. Others may have these profound cardiac signs of hyperkalemia, and they might have serum potassium, even with serum potassium in the low range. So if you run an ECG on them, you might see these tall, wide P waves and a prolonged PR interval, these wider QRS complexes that you can see on the arrows in the ECG on point D, and these much taller R waves as well too. So we can see we really need to be concerned about potassium when we're dealing with these diabetic ketoacidotic patients. So how do we do that? Effectively, all the textbooks are going to have some degree of a potassium supplementation. Potassium is the most major intracellular cation. Only 5% of it should be an extracellular fluid volume. And so, as I just mentioned, its most important function is that generation of a normal resting membrane potential, and particularly with our heart. And too much of it's going to cause an arrhythmia, and similarly, not enough is going to have a similar sort of effect. So potassium needs to go on board as soon as insulin is initiated. These are good ideas for, supplementation. You can use potassium chloride, add it to your bags of fluids. It's compatible with all the fluids we mentioned: sodium chloride, Hartmann's or lactated Ringer's, Plasmolite, Normosol. It can go into all those fluid bags. The only thing that you don't want to do is, if you're going to be giving high rates of fluids, is exceed this maximum milligrams per kilo per hour, because then again you're more likely to generate arrhythmias and problems with these diabetic patients. So too much is going to cause a hyperkalemia, make that resting membrane potential less negative, and cause that cell to be, hyperexcitable. But the minute you start insulin therapy, there can be quite a dramatic decrease in potassium. So this is the big thing to monitor as you start therapy, is watching what your electrolytes will actually be doing. So we know insulin basically pushes potassium back into the cell, and in exchange for hydrogen ions. So that's why it's really, really important. Phosphate is another one, is another intracellular component, and we often see a diabetic hypophosphatemia, and most people are aware of this in cats, but hypophosphatemia can also quite markedly affect small dogs as well too. And it's that impaired tissue use of phosphate, which is related to insulin deficiency. We're also in the diabetic state where we've got a urine, we can get urinary phosphate losses. We often might have a loss of muscle mass as well too. And again, our insulin's going to facilitate that phosphate entry back into the cells. So a general guide is often about a third of potassium supplementation should be given as potassium phosphate, so that we actually are addressing it as it's being pumped back into the cells themselves. And if we don't consider it, we often see hemolysis. We see that red blood cell fragility. We can also see intestinal ileus, weakness and pain. And hemolysis usually occurs once you get a phosphate less than about a millimole per liter. It's going to decline with the dilutional effect of fluid therapy and those intracellular shifts, and as you're going to be losing it with renal and GI losses. So it is our small cats and our dogs that are most susceptible to the hemolysis. Now, where I draw a cautionary tale here is that if you oversupplement it, it can cause metastatic calcification and hypocalcemia. So it will precipitate in lactated ringers. So if you're using Hartmann's or lactated ringers, you shouldn't really be adding phosphate to that fluid. But again, all of those other fluids, our plasmolite, our normosol, our sodium chloride, you can add phosphate into those. And as a supplementation, you can run it in as a CRI at, about 0.1 millimole per kilo per hour. I give it generally as an anticipation that I know, particularly in cats, that there's going to be a phosphate decrease. And I know that they're predisposed to developing hemolysis or a hemolytic anemia if I haven't addressed it. So as an anticipatory measure, I always give phosphate supplementation. It's easy to dilute in saline. As I said, it precipitates with calcium. And I usually give sodium chloride as well as, potassium chloride as well as potassium phosphate. And potassium phosphate is about a third of what I give to make sure that I'm addressing the phosphate requirements for the cat and for the dog. Now, magnesium is often the little forgotten cousin. 99% of it is going to be within the cell, and it's involved in both potassium and calcium transport. If you get a refractory hypokalemia, so if you're giving your potassium support and nothing's happening, you're thinking, why is my potassium either staying low or why is it dropping? It may be complicated by a low magnesium or a hypomagnesemia. And I generally will supplement it in these cases. So I don't give an anticipatory supplementation of magnesium. If I can't get any shifts of the potassium and I'm worried that the patient is not responding the way that I think it should, then I'm going to actually give magnesium. So typically in serum, magnesium is about 0.8 to 1.2 millimoles per liter. And if you've got in-house, I know the IDEX machine does, and I know everyone has different types of in-house measurements, but you can get a strip that can actually measure magnesium, so you can do this in-house when needed. And I will supplement, as I say, when it's persistent lethargy, persistent anorexia, and I just can't get that potassium to shift. And I'll give it as a CRI. So there is suggestion that within people that insulin may be more sensitive and you may even gain better glycemic control if you actually give magnesium, but it tends to be the potassium that drives my thought process as to when I actually supplement it. Similarly, it is not compatible with calcium or bicarbonate solutions, so you cannot sort of give it in your Hartmann solution. It needs to be with those other fluids that we actually mentioned. So you can get magnesium chloride and you can give that as a separate CRI. Now we get on finally to the insulin. How are we giving insulin and what type of insulin are we actually giving? So in the diabetic ketoacidotic patient, they're dehydrated, they're hypovolemic. We've covered that. And so this is why we don't give subcutaneous insulin to these patients. It's going to sit there in the dehydrated patient as a depot. And if you then get them hydrated, you may then see a sudden shift and drop. But it is not going to do much subcutaneously in that patient that is already dehydrated. So we don't give subcutaneous insulin to those. There are a number of different ways you can give insulin in the diabetic ketoacidotic. You can give it IV, you can give it intramuscularly. They'd be the two most common ways. Now, my preferred method is giving it intravenously. The only type of insulin we use is a regular insulin, and there are a few that are on the market, and again, depending where you are and which country you're in, is what's actually available. So down on the bottom corner, and again, I'll point it out, is typically, where's my arrow? Just here. I'm using this at the moment. This is what I have here available in the UK. So it's a regular insulin that we give IV, but there are a number of different other insulins available depending upon where you are. They're short acting, they're going to have a short duration of effect. So if I'm giving it IV as an infusion, I can up and down titrate very easily. Our issue is that it will bind to plastic. So you need to, once you've made up your solution, basically run the solution through the line before you deliver it to your patient. Otherwise, it's going to have minimal effect to start with. So you allow its plastic binding and then you keep going along with giving that insulin CRI. When you check it, if it's been sitting in the fridge for a while, make sure it's clear and colorless and looks like water basically. If it's got precipitate in it, if it's cloudy or it's thickened or has any kind of solid particle in it, throw it out because it is not, you shouldn't be giving it to it IV. It should look like water. Just and as a reminder, no Lenti, Isophane, or PZI, they shouldn't be given IV. It just must be that regular insulin that's actually given IV. So, how do we give it IV? There are a few different ways you can do it. And again, if you look at textbooks and different papers, it's working out what's going to be easiest for you because in this high pressure situation, I would say keep it simple. I've just noticed as a comment, what happens if you don't have soluble insulin? And I'm going to leave that for a couple of slides because there's a couple other options that we have out there. With the CRI of regular insulin, you can make up a 500 ml bag, so you can add it into your saline. You can make up this solution and give it at 0.1 units per kilo per hour, and then cut it back and supplement dextrose. And you're kind of aiming to get around with your DKA patient about 9 to 12 millimoles. So you're not sort of looking for the super high tight control, but you're getting it down to a point where this animal is hydrated. It's actually got an appropriate osmolality and a blood glucose we can work with. And once they're well hydrated and the animal's not having ongoing vomiting, diarrhea, and it's starting to eat, we're starting to look at when we get it across to our subcutaneous insulin. My preferred method is I dilute about 2.2 units per kilo of regular insulin into about a 250 ml bag. I usually add it into sodium chloride, and then I supplement glucose as actually needed. So this IV infusion, it's compatible with normal saline. It's compatible with dextrose, lactated ringers. So this is one that we can use with our Hartmann's, and any of the other sort of fluids that we actually mentioned. It's incompatible with many drugs. So if you're giving other IV drugs, you need to be cautious when giving an insulin CRI. It's compatible with drugs that you might be using, such as ampicillin. It is compatible with calcium, otherwise we couldn't give Hartmann's. It's compatible with heparin, metoclopramide you may be using as well, your magnesium it's compatible with. It's also compatible with our potassium phosphate. So the typical drugs that you might be using there, it is compatible with, but there are many drugs that it isn't. So you need to just be cautious with what you're putting in if you're using the same IV catheter or if you're using a line where you're putting multiple drugs down that line. You don't need to wait for the complete rehydration to be completed before you actually start insulin. So I will give them their intravenous fluids. I'm going to start on their rehydration process. And typically for me, depending upon how the patient's doing, sometimes around about 4 to 6 hours afterwards, if I'm happy their rehydration is going well, I'm going to probably start using a continuous infusion of regular insulin, and I'll just try and slowly cut back and reduce their glucose levels. If, as I said, it is short acting. So if I need to make rapid changes, I can do that based upon what they're doing. And it depends what glucose monitor you're using as to how fast you actually can recognize that and do that. And I'm going to come to that at a later slide. So with how we actually go about doing it, and again, I haven't forgotten about the question of what happens if you don't have insoluble or soluble insulin. I also have a question of why am I supplementing the glucose? Well, when am I supplementing the glucose? And hopefully this slide's going to answer that somewhat. When I have a really high blood glucose, so these guys often might come in with 26, 30 millimoles per liter of blood glucose. I'm going to start my insulin CRI as a higher rate. So we'll have made up that bag of insulin. I'm running it as a separate line to my IV fluids, and I'll be using Plasmolite or Hartmann's, or if only I had sodium chloride, I'd use that as well too. As I see my blood glucose decreasing, you can see I'm cutting back my insulin rate, and then I might start supplementing with dextrose. So a lot of people won't have 2.5% dextrose in stock. We actually don't here. And so an easy way to make up a bag of 2.5% dextrose is if you've got a liter of fluids, remove 50 mils from that bag and inject 50 mils of 50% glucose into that 1 liter. And that's going to give you a 2.5% bag of, 2.5% dextrose bag. Similarly, if you have your 5% dextrose that I might use later on, I'll remove 100 mils of fluid from a 1 liter bag, and I'll inject 100 mils of 50% glucose into that 1 liter to give me that 5% dextrose. So, in answer to the question of why am I supplementing glucose, I'm supplementing it because I don't want it to get it too low. So, I'm not supplementing it right at the start. When I'm giving glucose is when that blood glucose is creeping down, but I am still trying to correct the ketosis. These patients are often not wanting to eat yet. They're still metabolically unstable, so they're not able to have anything realistically orally. So I'm making sure that I'm not making the patient hypoglycemic by giving it too much glucose, but I'm giving by giving it too much insulin. I apologize. I am making sure that I'm getting rid of the ketosis by giving it insulin, but not letting that become hypoglycemic. So once my blood glucose starts to creep down, that's why I'm supplementing glucose into these patients because they're still ketotic, they still need insulin, but I'm making sure that they're also not becoming hypoglycemic at the same time. So I hope that answers that question of why I'm supplementing glucose. So all of the insulin dosage changes, all of my supplementation changes are based upon what the patient is doing. And frequent monitoring is the key to the management of these guys. Now, there are other options of giving insulin out there, and there's been a few papers that have come out in the kind of medicine literature, veterinary medicine literature recently, and using insulin Lispro. So if you've got Lispro, and these are more recent papers, and they're very, very similar. So they use that 2.2 units of Lispro insulin. They add it to a 250 ml bag of sodium chloride. They've discarded that first 10 mils by doing it. And similarly, they'll have the insulin that's being offered, and they'll be supplementing with dextrose as well too, as that blood glucose is coming down. Now, for those that are used to in the US, the milligrams per deciliter, you can see that off the on the side, and I'm going to skip back one slide. That's very, very similar to what it is in the other units, the millimoles per liter. So that gives you an idea that there are other options. With this particular therapy, with the Lispro, it's gained a little bit of favor in some areas because they did this nice study where that median time to resolution, because how fast do these guys resolve their hyperglycemia, their ketosis, and their acidosis? Well, with these Lispro, they're sort of saying on average it's about 26 hours, anywhere between 26 to 50 hours. So let's look at that. That's about 1 to 2 days. And that's in dogs that were treated with compared to dogs that were treated with regular insulin, so the other insulins that we were talking about, and that's saying roughly these guys were about 60 hours, so just a little bit longer, so just a little bit more than 2 days, 2 to 3 days in those particular cases. In cats, it was very similar that a lot of they've had some quite success with using the Lispro. And so in the few cats that were reported in this one paper, they sort of said one cat resolved in 9 hours, another in 44 hours, and another in 23 hours. So effectively 1 to 2 days as well too. And that was compared to cats, with regular insulin, although they still did really well at about 12, 62, and 41 hours. So kind of little difference, but it still shows that the insulin actually works. They suggested that this actually works a bit faster than everything else, but we're probably talking in the space of hours. So if you don't have soluble insulin in stock, there are other options there. So what are our other options? Intramuscular, because you cannot give sub, as I say, in the dehydrated patient, you should not give subcutaneous. You really want to give intramuscular insulin. And so, what you can do in this IM injection is give 0.2 units per kilo, and 2 hours later, check. So, you're checking their blood glucose and then you're responding. And this is a really good graph. It's out there in quite a few of the textbooks. If you are, can either continue original dosing, or you can decrease or up the doses based upon the responses. So you can use intramuscular insulin rather than subcutaneous insulin, is if you don't actually have, soluble insulin that you can put in a fluid, into fluids. And there was a nice, in cats in particular, this was presented a little while ago now. It was in 2010 it was presented, and it's actually been written up since, where feline cats were used glargine, so our long-acting insulin. And instead of giving it subcut, what they did was they gave intramuscular insulin, and in some of these cats, they combined it with subcutaneous insulin. And they found that it worked really, really quite well. In three cats, they sort of started the subcutaneous insulin after they'd resolved, but in the majority, they gave it as an IM and as a subcut injection. So if you don't have soluble insulin in stock, this is something that you can give to your cats while also managing the other components of their disease, i.e., their fluid volume, their potassium volume. But this was managed, this was how they managed cats with DKA with glargine, and that's something that you can do if you actually don't have soluble insulin in stock. So had quite good responses. So how do you go about monitoring? Lots of different options out there. So there's a study that's probably going to come out, or it may have just come out, in the American Journal of Veterinary Research, and they actually looked at what was the most useful way of measuring blood glucose, or what was the most consistent way to actually do it. And what we actually found was they found was that it seems to be better to measure from the ear and not from the mucous membrane, so not from oral blood or not from pricking on the pad. And what they did was they compared it to to their intravenous samples, and the ear prick seemed to be the most consistent and the most accurate. So the ear prick, and that is one way that you can do it, particularly, if people can't get intravenous, or you don't want to continue stabbing into a dog's vein and you want to preserve those. You can use the vein. If you're very, very into critical care, you can also place a jugular catheter, which you could use as well too, if you're able to keep that sterile and you've got the will and the desire to actually do it. But effectively, a lot of people consider the standard is this ear prick technique. It's not really that painful to most patients, and they usually tolerate it relatively well. But one of the other options is that these days is there are a lot of things on the market, and a constant blood glucose monitor may be something to consider. There are quite a few out there. Now, the dog in this slide has actually got a Medtronic analyzer place. So it's a tiny little wire that almost sort of goes into the subcutaneous area, and these are kind of the readings that you might get when you plug through the information. The one thing about that is you're not constantly stabbing the animal. It might just be off a little bit, but it's relatively close to what the blood glucose is doing. You can monitor the minute to minute because you've got a cage side app, or on a phone, or a cage side response. So you're sampling them less and you can see what they're doing. So it's kind of an advantage for those that don't like being stabbed at all the time. The disadvantage, now I'm going to say the disadvantage with the Medtronic, is that it needs to be calibrated. So you need to calibrate blood glucose to what the soft tissue or the subcutaneous tissue is measuring. And it can underdo it a little bit in the dehydrated patient. Also, its other problem is that the highest blood glucose reading you can get on it is 22 millimoles per liter. So these patients come in really, hypoglycemic, and it's going to read at 22, 22, 22 until that blood glucose starts coming down. Now, the other one that's seeming to gain a little bit more favor is, if you can get access to it, is the Freestyle Libra. And that there have been big advancements with this Freestyle Libra. It's the Freestyle Libra 14-day is self-calibrating, so you don't need to calibrate these things so much. So you basically have zero ear pricks or blood draws for your patient. They last for 14 days, so you can leave them on for a long period of time. It just calibrates within an hour, whereas the Medtronic takes a little bit longer to calibrate. It can take 4 hours overall, 4 to 6 hours, I think, to calibrate, where the Freestyle Libra 14-day actually calibrates quite quickly. So it could be quite a useful way if you're seeing frequent diabetics in the clinic or frequent patients with DKA. It's a nice way to actually cut back the sampling and not have your dogs be quite so aggressive or not so happy about having being pricked at all the time. And in some patients, we use these for some of our chronic diabetics, is the owners will take them home, which is kind of useful in some of the cats if they're happy just doing the calibrations, because we're still using the Medtronic, and you can actually measure what's happening at home and not having to worry about the stress hypoglycemia when they're in hospital. So there's been some recent studies, and this is one from the Veterinary Journal of Critical Care, where they actually looked at these continuous blood glucose measuring systems. And this was, I think, the Freestyle Libre that was used in this particular case, and it was actually quite accurate. They compared it to their blood glucoses, and that degree of accuracy is something that would suggest to us that we've kind of moved ahead, and this is something that we should be looking forward to the future. But if you're really worried about the patient being able to have staff available to continue blood sampling, it's something that maybe you can consider for the practice to make your life a little bit easier. The other question that often gets asked is, what particular type of monitoring device should I use? The AlphaTrack is out there. It's designed for our veterinary patients. It's very accurate. It takes into consideration of the size of the red blood cells. So cat and dog red blood cells are a different size to people. So something like the Glucometer Elite, it will be maybe have a slight difference. And there was a study that we did that looked at these monitors, and there is a very minor difference between the AlphaTrack and the Glucometer Elite. Now, if any of the human blood glucometers are used, the fact is you just want to stick with the one glucometer, because you're trending these patients. Sometimes it's not so much about the number, but it's actually the trend. So if you're using the glucometer, a human blood glucometer, continue to use the same one, because you want to get that same measurement. So again, apologies, they're in American units designed for the American market, not for the English or the Australian market that's actually there. Now, I said acidosis at the start. When do you correct your acidosis? A pH of 7 is a life-threatening acidosis, and if the time that I will go about correcting it is if I've given this patient fluids, it's maybe not responding that well, and we're constantly seeing a low pH, we're seeing a low POC2, and we're seeing a low bicarb as well too. So if we've rehydrated them, they're normovolemic and they're not improving, and that kind of CO2 is down below 12 millimoles, the pH is below 7.1, then I might consider dosing them with bicarb. And so my preferred technique is I tend to use the equation at the top. So I'll use their body weight by 0.4. And the 0.4 is basically a correction factor for the extracellular fluid space. So that's where bicarb is mainly distributed, i.e., about 40% of body weight. So that's the 0.4. 12 is my value where I'll consider treating if they're well hydrated. And then whatever the patient's current bicarb is. And then there's a fudge factor, and it's a well-known fudge factor. We basically give it's it makes the dose conservative. So we give half of it back over about a 6 hour period. And once we hit an HCO3 or a bicarb of greater than 12 millimoles, I don't give further bicarb. The patient is actually then usually starting to self-correct. There is a simpler equation where some people will give, bicarb, at the rate of 2 times the body weight, and they'll correct over 6 hours. But I think using that more complicated formula, you're less likely to cause harm if you need to correct the acidosis. And so why are we doing it? Is we know that acidosis is going to interfere with insulin binding. On the negative, it can also exacerbate hypokalemia. It will As a positive, we know that bicarb resolving, or that, or sorry, the acidosis resolving, the bicarb are going to assist with management of arrhythmias, increase cardiac output, help with hypotension, and our CNS changes. But it can delay the reduction in ketones. It can delay the reduction in lactate as well as ketones, and it can also contribute, because it's sodium bicarb, to sodium overload. So that's why we're always going to give it in the well-hydrated patient. So there's positives and negatives to it, which is why I recommend, if you have a well-hydrated patient and its bicarb is still actually, if it's still quite acidotic, that this is the time that you actually go about and start actually supplementing. So I'm very aware of how we're going on time. How do we monitor? And I hopefully we'll finish very shortly. So what do we do with our ketones? We effectively, they should decrease once the insulin has started. So hypoglycemia is always going to resolve first, as it's determined primarily by dehydration and a decrease in the GFR. Once we start giving fluids, once we start the diuresis, that hypoglycemia is going to resolve. Then we give the insulin, and that's when we're expecting our ketones to resolve. Often our DKA patients, they may have some degree of blood pressure issue. And if you've given them fluids and that hypotension's not resolving, we're really aiming to get their blood pressure above 80 milligrams of mercury. You can consider things like noradrenaline or dopamine. Now, my preferred method is I tend to more commonly use noradrenaline, and I might start them at 0.05 micrograms per kilo per minute, and then I'll increase that effect over over responses, and to a maximum of about 0.3 micrograms per kilo per minute. So that's tends to be my preference. If you've got dopamine in stock, you can use it. And again, I often sort of start around 2 to 3 micrograms per kilo per minute, and then I'll increase. It's very rare that I would get up to 20. Usually about 5 to 8 micrograms per kilo per minute is where I end up if I have to. But effectively, as as your mean arterial pressure or as your blood pressure increases, you might also see a decrease in heart rate. So if they've got a hypotension and their heart is working overtime to compensate for that, your response should be a drop in blood pressure. An increase in blood pressure and a drop in your heart rate. So the other component, as we move along, is how are we going to monitor? I monitor their urine out. If I'm worried about an AKI, I might catheterize them. You may have a central venous line-in, but let's face it, oftentimes you just need to stick with the basics. So I'm keeping an eye on their blood pressure. I'm keeping an eye on their respiratory signs. I very rarely measure central venous pressure, but I am monitoring their electrolytes every 4 to 6 hours because, as we said, potassium, and phosphate and sodium, we might be needing to adjust our fluids based upon how they're shifting. And the blood glucose may be every hour initially. I might then back off to every 2 hours, and as the patient stabilizes, it becomes less frequent after that. But it'd be very unusual for me to actually measure central venous pressure as it's being done in this dog just here. So they're just using a sort of straight handheld manometer, and it's very fiddly, so I don't do that very, very commonly. Nutrition is often forgotten, and being respectful of time, what I'm just going to say is that we will place a nasogastric tube fairly quickly. So once that we've achieved normovolemia, we've managed their hydration, we're going to get a nasogastric tube in place. We're going to start feeding it, or start trickle feeding it in, because we want to start this patient back to being as normal as possible. The other option is if we get a stable patient, we may put an esophageal feeding tube in place, and I think they're really well tolerated by most cats. They're quite happy to have them in place. But it will give us something to be able to work with towards getting them out of hospital a little bit faster. But the first thing we might use is a nasogastric feeding tube. What do we feed in cats? High protein diet, low carbohydrate diet. It's probably out of the bounds of the DKA discussion, but effectively we want to be feeding the cats a little bit higher in fat, a little bit low in carbohydrate, a little bit high in protein. And there's a lot of discussion in the literature as to what to actually feed a cat. I think what we just need to remember is that cats have no salivary amylase and they have a very low intestinal and pancreatic amylase, which is why they don't tolerate high amounts of carbohydrate. So their natural diet is about 10% carbohydrate, about 35% fat, and about 55% protein. Now, most diets don't feed them quite that high a fat, but the component is they have very poor ability to actually metabolize carbohydrate. Their livers have they have decreased glucokinase, which is why when you're actually looking at cats, their blood glucose can take 8 to 10 hours to return to normal because they don't have the glucokinase in their livers that people and dogs do. And the feline liver doesn't contain fructokinase either. So that's why I think it's really important to get these owners to get them onto diabetic foods, if at all possible, that are designed for these particular cats and their unique nutritional requirements. In dogs, we give them the same protein as non-diabetics. It's the fat, it should be a less than about 30%. And what we have found is the carbohydrate has a strong association with the pre-meal insulin dosage required and the postprandial glycemic response to the carbohydrate content of the meal. So it doesn't matter so much, the amount, well, the type, but it's more so the amount that they're actually given. So again, it's usually recommended to have a diet high in soluble fiber, low in those simple sugars, and moderately restricted in fat and protein. So it needs to be balanced, but the most important thing in dogs is the consistency. So starting to get towards wrapping up, when do we actually start using long-acting insulin and what are our options? When the patient's off intravenous fluids, when they're eating, where they're drinking, when there's no vomiting, and when that ketoacidosis is resolved. So when they're metabolically stable is when I'll start phasing them onto their subcutaneous insulin. So towards the end of the CRI for me, if we offer them food and they start to eat, that's when I know that when I've got a resolution of the ketoacidosis, I'm going to start backing away the intravenous fluids. I'm going to offer them that meal and then I'm going to see how they go and start transitioning them onto subcutaneous fluids. Oh, sorry, subcutaneous insulin. And what you use, well, certainly here in the UK, you need to use, your recommendation should be what is on the cascade. So can insulin and Prozinc being the two that actually are on the cascade. But there is a lot of information out there on the use of glargine as well too, and now sort of obviously our other insulins that are on the market. So it's finding out what's going to be most useful for that particular animal and then going with it. I would start most dogs I find on cat insulin, and I do have to say that I'm using Prozinc a little bit more in cats, and sometimes I'm varying between the glargine and the Prozinc based upon their long response. When do you send them home? After two insulin injections and they haven't had any hypoglycemia, because that's when they're going to have the issues, is if they become hypoglycemic at home. We can manage them when they're slightly hypoglycemic, but if my subcutaneous insulins, when they're eating appropriately, that's when I'll send them home. And I think the most important part of the discharge after a DKA event is what you say at the discharge. That's going to be the key to success. So I will talk to the owners about what I'm looking for in signs of hyperglycemia and hypoglycemia, so they know when they might need to give glucose or honey onto the gums. We actually do practice saline injections so the owner feels comfortable using the needle before they go home. And so they'll just do a few insulin saline injections to make sure they're comfortable. We discuss what happens with a Shimogi effect so they understand how important it is that this patient is now going to be regularly monitored by their ref vet. These are the ones that do the most or do the best after they go home. We may use urine glucose monitoring in some patients, and if they're obese, we get them into a weight loss program. And again, that just maintains the vet-client relationship as well too. So when we talk about the Shimogi effect, I have to say I pull up this graph with the owners and I sort of say to them, what we can actually see with a Shimogi is that if we're giving too much insulin, so if we're giving too much insulin, we're getting a rebound effect where our stress hormones are shooting us up, and then we think we're giving them too much insulin, but in fact, or not enough insulin, but in fact we're giving them too much. So I go through our aim of what we actually really desire, which is this nice steady curve, which may just take a little bit of time when the animal gets home to actually achieve. So we get this kind of nadir down around about sort of 5 to 7 millimoles per liter of blood glucose at that, midway through the 2 injections of the day. So I'll let them know what I'm looking for and the reasons why, because I think a lot of owners are a little bit more compliant if you can explain the reasons of why you need to monitor them regularly and not starting them on a dose and that they're fixed for life so they do come back and see you. And then in finishing off, finally, what I would say is this is the time then that we may need to consider, we also need to consider other diseases. So the biggest one I'm going to mention is just hyperadrenocorticism. And there's been some research that's been discussed recently which has found sort of the risk factors for diabetic dogs to have hyperadrenocorticism are often that they're pituitary dependent, they're often the intact female, they may have triglycerides above half a millimole per liter, which is about 45 milligrams per deciliter. Or they might have a cholesterol above 4.24 millimoles, which is actually not that high, which in American units, about 164 milligrams per deciliter, or a fasting blood glucose that is, much higher than 5.5, which again is quite low. And you're sort of thinking, well, that doesn't really help me. But in the dog that seems to be somewhat insulin resistant, once they're at home and they've stabilized best we can, that's when I start go looking for any other concurrent disease. Similarly, in the cat that may have acromegaly, again, we want to make sure there's insulin on board and the cat is, I've stabilized the cat before I actually start looking for could there be acromegaly, which is compounding things going on in this cat. So they're the diseases that we might consider concurrently. And obviously some of those, pancreatitis, urinary tract infections, sepsis, they will have been part of your initial investigation and you will have dealt with them along the way. But it's such a bigger conversation to actually be had in the short space of time that we're allowed today. And I think we've just gone on beyond an hour. So I'm going to wrap up because I think there's been an awful lot of information there. Hopefully, I've answered all the questions that have sort of fired up along the screen. But I'm going to wrap up now unless anyone has any further questions. And thank you very much for your attendance today.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Amanda for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.